We open the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Good morning, everybody. Today is March 14th, 2017. And we've got one of our colleagues here to testify. Just one. Yeah. And so just making sure we don't have anybody else. So we're going to open up public hearings on House Bills 2893 and 2894 and ask Representative Bueller to join us to talk about these two bills. Do you want to bring Eric with you?
Yeah,
sure. Been reading about these in my email inbox. Excited to hear about the proponent's view of these bills rather than just the emails.
That's always nice. Good morning, Chair Klim, Vice Chairs, and esteemed colleagues. Thanks for the opportunity to testify on 2893 and 94. For the record, my name is Representative Newt Bueller. I represent House District 54, which is most of the city of Bend. I'm here mostly to set the context, but also to speak in support of both of these bills. They come to you from the city of Bend, and it is really a reflection of our now nearly 10 years experience with the urban growth boundary expansion process. As you may recall, the city of Bend has gone through two of those processes over the last 6 years, and we've learned quite a bit. Last long session, we brought you a bill that you honored us in passing, which allowed for sequential approval process of the UGB expansion. And we've learned other things through this latest round, and 2893 and 94, I think, really attempts to modernize the UGB expansion process. So we really see this as helping a process that now is nearly 50 years old to become more attuned with the needs of growing cities like like Bend and hopefully others in Oregon. So I'll leave the details to Mr. Kanzler and Eric.
All right, thank you, Representative. Chair Klem, members of the committee, for the record, Eric Kanzler representing the city of Bend. I will walk through the bills conceptually as well as provide some context about where they came from, why we're talking about them now, et cetera, et cetera. Unfortunately, planning staff from the city wasn't able to be here today. They have all-day meetings, so if there are technical questions, I'll do my best to answer them. Otherwise, I will have to get back to you. So first off, a quick description of the two bills. And in both cases, we should be talking about the -1 amendments, which are refining and narrowing. The original bills were drafted a little bit too broadly, so the -1s will take things down a notch. So first, House Bill 2893-1 is about soil classes, and what it would ultimately do is to increase the priority of very low-quality agriculturally zoned land to come into either a UGB expansion or an urban reserve, a facilitation of an urban reserve process. And 2894 would allow cities to account for redevelopment limitations on rural subdivisions outside of urban growth boundaries and help us to better determine the projected housing capacity of those lands. So I'll walk through the details in a second, but first I'd like to say a little bit about where these bills came from. In the 2016 session, of course, housing was a focus for a lot of people in a lot of different ways. And in particular for myself and representing the city of Bend, I found myself having a number of conversations about the intersection of land use policy and housing needs, because there's, I think a broad recognition that the two are related. And a lot of folks came to me and said, hey, you know, the city of Bend is now in the final throes, hopefully, which actually proved to be the case of its UGB expansion process. It's a city that does take planning very seriously and has had to take planning very seriously given the rapid growth that we face and the housing shortages that we're looking at. So the question was, what, if anything, can you guys come up with that will help address our land supply concerns in a very nuanced fashion, something that would be ultimately in the spirit of the land use system, that would take resource conservation, that would take smart growth and all the things we care about into account? Can you guys come up with something like that? And I said, I'm not sure. That's historically been a tough nut to crack, but let's take a shot. So I talked to the city. We had a number of broad conversations about what that might look like, and we hit upon two primary limitations to achieving the clearly achieving our ability to meet community needs as we expand the UGB. And so that's why now. We had a recent process, and some folks have said, well, you just finished. Why are you back here talking about it so quickly? So for the record, the city's focus on housing needs is primarily about serving its existing land supply with infrastructure, promoting infill, so on and so forth. But as you know, planners typically think within 20-year planning horizons. Within that horizon, we're clearly going to need more land. We're growing rapidly. We might as well start those considerations now while the recent process is fresh in mind. So that being said, what these two bills have in common is the desire of the city of Bend to move, I would say, uniformly in an eastward direction. Typically, Bend is literally right at the base of the Cascades, as you probably all know. We have forest land to the west, we have desert land to the east. And although it's not simple, it's too simple to say that we could either go west or we could go east. It's likely going to be a mix of both. But we have a strong preference to go east for a number of reasons. One, the land on the east side of the city is inexpensive. Two, the cost of infrastructure is very inexpensive relative to other options. We have big parcels of land. They can be master planned with complete communities. They could provide for the full range of needed housing. They are, quite frankly, are near transit corridors. They have bike ped facilities, or at least the potential for bike ped facilities in ways that the West doesn't. So we really see the East as the future in terms of being able to meet the needs of the broad community. To the West, we have lands that are more expensive. We have lands that are far more expensive to serve with critical infrastructure. The land is much further from the urban core. It's more difficult to serve with transit. It's not very bike ped friendly. It's not near jobs. And frankly, the forest land to the west of the town is high fire risk. It has wildlife value, and it clearly has scenic and recreational value that people prize tremendously. So going east is really, we feel, in the interests of the community and, frankly, to a large extent, in the interest of conserving resources that we see around town. So let's get back to the details of the little, how do these bills relate to that goal? Now, the first bill, House Bill 2894, again, relates to how we account for limits to the redevelopment of rural subdivisions that are quite prominent east of town, more so than most communities. So imagine that you have a 100-acre rural subdivision, say it was built in the 1960s. Maybe it is 2-acre lots, 50 homes, at an assumption of, if it were to redevelop at 8 units per acre in an urban density, that would be 100 homes that land could accommodate. In reality, some of these developments, they're very high-value homes. They're established neighborhoods. The improvement value greatly exceeds the underlying land value. They're very desirable neighborhoods, and above and beyond that, they are largely burdened with codes, covenants, and restrictions that prevent subdivision, prevent accessory dwelling units, and things of that nature. So while on paper, this theoretical development may yield 800 units, in actuality, it may not yield any redevelopment potential at all. Yet, under current policy, it's really unclear what we can do about accounting for that limitation. There probably exists some ability to do that. We received a letter from DLCD in 2010 during the earlier phases that Representative Bueller mentioned of our recent UGB expansion process that said, yeah, you guys are probably going to have trouble addressing these, and we're really not sure how to provide guidance to you. So what House Bill 2894 would do would be ask the department to go through a rulemaking process to clarify an option for cities to look at doing this if they wanted to. This is something that I would say it was discussed in the recent rulemaking advisories committee extending from House Bill 2254, but it was never resolved. It was never actually taken up and codified in any fashion. So that is that issue. And for the second issue, House Bill 2893, I want to walk through a pretty rough presentation that I put together. And I live in Bend, by the way, and I used to live in East Bend, so this was land that I'm familiar with. So what House Bill 2893 would do is it would elevate the priority of land of agriculturally zoned lands that have predominantly soil classes 7 and 8. For those of you that are unfamiliar, the NRCS classifies soil on a 1 to 8 scale. 8 is the worst, 1 is the best. So if you look east of town, and I'll show you a map in a little bit, there is a soil complex here, 58C, that's comprised predominantly of three different types of soil. There's the Gosney soil, which is 50% of the area. There's rock outcroppings that literally comprise a quarter of this land, and there's the Descamp soil, actually not sure how to pronounce that. Descamp, maybe 20% of the units is class 6. It is class 4 when irrigated. So the setting here, and this is from the NRCS, the Gosney soil exists in these soil mounds, and the Descamp soil exists in these swales, sort of the lowlands. And for the most part, the swales exist in these odd, irregular, small formations. So while class 6 soil on its own it can be incredibly productive, in this geographical formation, it really doesn't lend to irrigation. There are these tiny, little, irregularly spaced areas with reasonable quality soil mixed in and dominated by the rock outcroppings and the Gosney soil. So as the text up there shows, we're talking about lava plains, we're talking about ash, western juniper, sagebrush, bitterbrush, different types of native grasses. A little bit more on that.
Hey, Eric, yes. 1 second. Vice Chair Springer's got a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I noticed...
Should I go back?
Just switch slides. You've got, like, on the second bullet point, class 8 soils. The first bullet point, 7E soils. I don't think I know what the E stands for.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Springer, quite frankly, neither do I. But I will ask. It is a subclassification of class 7. There are a couple different subclassifications that define minor variations in those soils. So I can research that and get back to the committee.
Brief follow-up
with the detail.
Yeah.
I am interested in that. I don't know if the E would indicate it's almost a 6, or
good question.
It just further classifies it. So that's important information.
I will make sure to follow up. So the NRCS classifies this in terms of its uses as land that's suitable for livestock grazing, but frankly not necessarily ideal for livestock grazing. Again, it's got rock outcroppings. It has soil depth, permeability, rock fragment issues. I won't go through the management considerations in detail. This is in there for the record. So prior to picking my daughter up from school on Friday, she lives out in East Bend, I decided I was going to head out there with a camera and a map and document what some of this 58C soil looks like. The desert's it's a beautiful landscape out there, and this presentation is by no means an effort to suggest that this land is lacking in value. What we're talking about is land that is near the UGB that has an urbanization potential. So the policy question that we're asking here is, how are we going to weigh the various merits of this land, both in a developed and an undeveloped form? It's not rendering a judgment on this as bad land or worthless land or anything of that nature. But as you can see, very similar to how the NRCS describes the soil, you can see the junipers, you can see the sagebrush, you can see the rock outcroppings, and that doesn't really look like I think it's quite beautiful, frankly, but it doesn't really look like what we expect ag land to look like. And this is out, I should say, on the Stevens Road track. This is owned by the Department of State Lands. The profits, should this land sell, would of course be go to the Common School Fund. So here's another similar view. Again, you can see the same general features. A third view, this is a little bit flatter. I don't know if this is a swale per se, but again, you can see even by this picture, the soil is filled with rocks. It's ash, it's pumice, it's very thin, quite frankly. So not far away, east of town along Neff Road, just out past Hamby, you can see from the road a similar looking setting. Here's a picture of a solar farm out on this soil. Quite frankly, there's two solar farms. I think they're about 120 acres or so, just east of town, east of Big Sky Park. And right nearby, a large swath of right-of-way devoted to power lines. So let's take a look at a map And it'll give you a geographical sense of what we're talking about here. So again, 58C soils, they're really the only major soil complex east of Bend that would fit the criteria in the dash one of the bill, which again focuses on predominantly 7 and 8 soils. And can I walk over there? Is that up? So obviously the urban growth boundary presently is here. You can see some examples of the rural subdivisions that I mentioned up here. And up there we have Big Sky Park, we have Buckingham Elementary School, the solar farms have been developed down here. You can see that the right-of-way that I showed is here, just for a little bit of context. You have Neff Road running east, Hamby Road running this way, and then the map shows the ownership, the parcelization of these lands as well. And of course, off to the right, you can actually see land that was that is irrigated from different soil classes. I would say predominantly soil classes 6, although I don't think there's anything better than 6, frankly, at least unirrigated 6. Again, it's 6 can turn into 4 with water on it. So predominantly what we're looking at with 58C is soils that have never been irrigated, likely won't be unirrigated, and while they are suitable for grazing and rangeland when they are in large tracts east of town, in this condition, in this geographical formation where they are surrounded by different land use, different uses, and some of those uses are actually interspersed within that land, there's really nothing left intact. These are never going to serve, quite frankly, as grazing land in any functional sense, even though they possess the same characteristics as similar land east of town. And so just to finish up on this, if you look, this is just zooming all the way back, the area that is very crudely shaded in blue, what we're talking about is the potential for small portions of that to develop east of Bend, about clarifying increasing the priority of those lands for inclusion in the urban growth boundary.
Representative Barreto.
In the last section, there looked like there was a couple of, in the last
last slide?
Yeah, last slide. Up there in the north area, it looks like irrigated land up there. The 36A looks like that might be irrigated land. So where do they get the water from those? Is that from wells or?
That's a good question, Chair Clem. Representative Barreto, predominantly we have irrigation canals. Central Oregon Irrigation District would be the primary provider of water. I think there are a couple cases where you can see pivot wells in there, so it might be a mix of uses.
Thank you.
Mix of sources, I should say. So again, at the landscape level,
Chair Clem, can I just comment on that too? Representative Barreto, that there is no possibility of more water getting to the land that Mr. Chancellor is referring to. There's already high demands on all that irrigation right now, so it couldn't spread to other lands east of Bend.
Okay. Appreciate it.
Vice Chair McClain.
I just wanted to make clear that as I've been reading these bills, you have just finished your urban reserve process.
Urban.
Chair Clem,
your urban
growth boundary.
Do you have urban reserves?
Presently, we don't have urban reserves.
No. So, I mean, the first go, at the state law, is that you're required to have both urban and rural reserves. So, where are you in that urban and rural reserve process?
So I think they're not required to have only Metro has the rural reserve part.
Well, yeah. Let's start with urban. Urban reserve. Do you guys have urban reserves?
Chair Clem, Representative McClain, we don't have urban reserves at present. I know the city of Redmond to the north of us has an urban reserve. I think very few cities actually have urban reserves, and that is a strong consideration for us going forward. I think that my understanding is the designation of an urban reserve would be on the table, as well as a potential next step prior to expanding the urban growth boundary. And I should say that House Bill 2893, as amended by the dash one, it doesn't just address the prioritization of land for inclusion in an urban growth boundary. It addresses the prioritization for land that would be included in an urban reserve as well. With UGBs, there are what's referred to as the priority statutes. I don't remember the.
And that's what you're talking about,
yes.
Is changing the priority status and statute.
Yes.
And so that's what I'm trying to understand is you know, because it looks like you're hopping in the middle of a process. So I'm just trying to understand what you're trying to do as far as planning for your next urban areas. And one of the ways to do it, as you point out, is urban reserves.
Correct.
Another way to do it, tell me about it. What are you doing?
Chair Clem, Representative McLean, point well taken. Like I said, urban reserves are very much on the table. And what we're effectively doing we're not attempting to rush forward with the next phase of the process. As I said, these are the presentation of these bills this session is largely due to conversations stemming from 2016 about, you know, what is Bend going to do short-term, mid-term, long-term. We have a residential vacancy rate of about or less than 1%, so it's really a comprehensive approach. There's a lot of things we're doing in the short term, like I said, prioritizing infill, provision of infrastructure, so on and so forth. In terms of looking at the long term, we are 2893 in particular would focus on making the same policy change for urban reserves as it would for urban growth boundary expansion. So it would amend the priority statutes for UGB expansions, and it would direct the Department of Land Conservation and Development to make the same change in the priority rules for urban reserves. So whereas urban growth boundary priorities are set in statute, urban reserve priorities mirror those, but they're set in rules. So the bill has those two elements. So if we did pursue urban reserves, this bill would actually clarify our ability to grow east in that regard. So we really are trying to keep, we are looking at both options very seriously. Thank you for the question. That's pretty much all I have. I think that in terms of the context here, again, the point here is to say, not to minimize, frankly, that we're urbanizing land, because we clearly are. We have to in the future at some point. We've got the high-value forest lands to the east that we're trying to avoid unnecessarily converting. We have low-quality agricultural lands to the east that we would prefer to urbanize on. We have wonderful rangeland with very similar soil characteristics. That rangeland east of Bend, again, fragmented, parcelized, bounded by a variety of land uses and really not functioning as grazing land. So just to wrap up, you know, we are very aware of the fact that there is some opposition to this bill. I think, frankly, a lot of it was oriented towards 2893 as drafted. It's unfortunate the bill was drafted more broadly than it should have been to include classic soils, and I think, unfortunately, has led to a perception of our intent. So the dash ones will alleviate some of those concerns. And more broadly speaking, I think from a community perspective, most everybody wants the city to have a clear option to grow to the east for a lot of very similar reasons that I mentioned before. The real question is how. How can we clearly do that? And in that regard, I would say the city is not wed to a particular outcome, a particular policy mechanism to accomplish that. These were the ones that we, in scrutinizing the obstacles presented by the current land use statutes and rules, these were two things that we identified that have not been resolved in recent rulemaking processes. We don't want to rehash issues that have already been resolved. These are new policy obstacles. If there are other ways of addressing these concerns, I think the city is definitely all ears and willing to have an open conversation about those. Thank you.
I will say that my first 5 years here, I remember many conversations about why can't Ben just grow east? Why do they keep trying to go north and west? So it sounds like that part's resolved, but the question for you is now that you're trying to go east, is the current law sufficient to do it, or do you need
right.
some tweaks? Because I would like to somehow get Richard Whitman back on the back in the slot where I can command him down here on land use, because I remember him specifically saying if they would just go east, we wouldn't have so much conflict.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, sorry.
Representative Esquivel, then to Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, actually, Ben, if you go north, you're running into agricultural land that is irrigated. To the west is the Cascades, and to the south is nothing but trees and forest. So they're pretty much locked in. There's only one way they can really go.
Vice Chair McClain.
The other item that looks like you affect in these two bills, and I'm trying to look at these dash ones to see if it's changed it much, but is the buildable land inventory. And one of the things that you talked about was the rural subdivisions.
Yes.
Now, are those rural subdivisions, because if you brought those in, those are already urbanized. They have some infrastructure. Are they rentals, or are they second homes, or what are they?
Chair Klein, Representative McClain, for the most part, as I understand, the makeup of those rural subdivisions is they are long-time permanent residences, their first homes.
Okay. So the one thing that you said that I do have a little bit of a question about is the fact that if you did bring it inside the urban growth boundary, it wouldn't change. There's a lot of folks that, you know, may think that, but I mean, once something's brought into the urban growth boundary, there are ways to, you know, to look at that property differently from the owner's perspective too.
Yeah.
And so it's one of those things that I'm not sure that I consider that to be a completely, you know, balanced statement.
Okay.
But you're looking as if you're dealing with both buildable lands as well as trying to change the prioritization of either urbanization or urban reserves.
Chair Klem, can I respond?
Sure.
Chair Klem, Vice Chair McClain. The interesting part about those parcels are they predated a lot of the land use planning system, and they have very strict covenants that you can't change, even if the owners of that land wanted to change it, and it may in the future, but those strict covenants really overrule anything else that those owners would want to do with the land. So it's one of the problems we have.
There's an area of Salem that's in the UGB, I think it has been for quite a long time, that are one-acre lots, and the owners don't sell them, and they don't subdivide them, even though they might be able to make more money. I assume doing that, they just, for whatever reason, don't, called Jan Ray. And I've been interested for a while, since Eric talking about these bills, and knowing, is that already accounted for? Do we already somehow, as the city of Salem, do we already project that those aren't likely to ever change because the owners like it that way? And if so, do you count them as buildable or not? And I gather there is some ability for cities to already discount those, but that's one of the things we're trying to get at in this discussion, is when you do have lands like that that don't seem likely to change because of owner behavior, what do you do? Do you assume they're buildable, or do you discount them half, or how that works? And I don't know the answer to that.
Chair Klem, I think that broadly speaking, we don't know the answer to that. I think it would be unfair of me to say that these will never, under no circumstances, develop. I mean, clearly there are possibilities. We do have some lands that have been incorporated in the past in a similar fashion. One of the neighborhoods in the southeast of Bend off 15th Street is called the King's Forest neighborhood. It's a little more compact than these. I think it's about one unit per three-quarter acres or 1 acre. And by and large, they haven't, almost to a rule, at least at this point, they haven't redeveloped. So when you bring in this land, the question we're fundamentally asking is, what's its likelihood of redevelopment within the planning horizon, within 20 years? It's not a permanent statement on will these ever redevelop, because conditions might change in 20 years. They might look different, and we actually would have the opportunity to reevaluate their developability at that time. So, you know, again, to Vice Chair McClain's point, I certainly can't sit here and say that they'll never develop and we should consider them as such. At this point, however, within the planning horizon, it doesn't look like most of these will. And there's a lot of difference in opinion. I've heard some folks say, well, on the one hand, land use laws clearly allow you to account for this, but they don't allow you to account for it in a clear fashion. So while we might reasonably agree on what the limitations look like, it's really ripe for legal appeal. There's really no safe harbor to account for these more extreme situations. There is some ability to do this sort of discounting, but again, it's somewhat nebulous at the same time. And one point of clarification in regarding the buildable lands inventory, because the original bill did propose to clarify, I don't mean to look at that, it's for the other bill, frankly, it did propose to clarify these issues both inside and outside of the UGB. The dash one clarifies that we're only talking about lands outside of the UGB. After talking with the Department of Land Conservation and Development, we were firmly convinced that they had done an excellent job and that we have a set of workable rules for addressing these limitations on lands inside UGBs and the formal buildable lands inventories.
Well, before you gentlemen go, I'll see if there's any more questions, and we've got three people to testify. I do know that this is not a completely academic exercise for Ben, given you've got no vacancy rates at all for renters and, you know, compression, you know, population demand and limited supply. I do think that Representative Bueller and I have a bill other people might be interested in, too, about what happens when you make a swath of land available via UGB expansion like you just did, and is the infrastructure available, and how do you get the money to do it? Because that's the other issue with the housing affordability. It's if you just open up a 2,000 new acres like we did in Washington County by legislative action, but the cities can't serve it because they don't have the finances right. Under 547 and 50, that didn't really do much good towards the housing issue. And so we've introduced a bill last week, I think, that tries to get at sort of the SDC-related issue.
Sure.
Because there's all kinds of good people wanting to work on this, but you also have to take on multiple challenges beyond just the UGB.
That is, Chair Clem, a very important point for us as well. As I mentioned before, the primary priorities for the city are utilizing its existing land supply effectively, which of course involves both the recently expanded areas as well as the infill areas where we're looking at urban renewal and you know, maybe vertical housing and all kinds of other incentives to provide a full range of housing stock. Those are the immediate needs. When we look at these issues, it's really more of a fundamentally long-range planning exercise. It certainly shouldn't be taken to suggest that this is somehow more important than these other issues. This is part of the larger package that we feel compelled to look at with vacancy rates as low as they are.
Well, as you and I know from our earlier work, when you suddenly dive into a land use issue like the Metolius, while it's a live issue, people get really upset.
Yes.
When you talk about it too far in advance, people don't feel a sense of urgency and don't really want to talk about it. And so trying to find somewhere in the middle is not always easy.
Yeah, and Chair Clem, we're trying to learn from our previous expansion efforts and try to apply those for future needs. And as you can see, this land would be very expensive to put infrastructure in, you know, putting sewer, especially roads, through such rocky surface. And so what I've learned, and I know you shared this, is some of the problems with regards to our affordable housing crisis is even though we have land that can be developed, for example, in Bend, we expanded over 2,000 acres, but it's estimated that only 1,000 of those acres have any infrastructure that could be built on in any near term. So it's a big problem for us.
I have to.
Vice Chair McLean.
To that, I mean, that's an important issue, and everybody, you know, the buzzword is affordable housing, right? Okay, that's all over. And the situation is here, again, as you point out, you can put acreage in until you're blue in the face.
Yeah.
And as Chair Clem just said, you've got to talk about infrastructure costs.
Yeah.
And there also are some other issues. You've got to have builders willing to build affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you have high infrastructure costs, the desire has been to build at the top of the range.
That's right.
And so there are some responsibilities for cities to look at their needs. And if you've got needs for rentals, then you've got to be putting in property where rentals are going to be built. So, you know, that's also part of the process of urban reserves is dealing with who your population is and what your infrastructure costs are. So I'm hopeful that since you want to talk about it early, it seems that there's a lot of work to do on an urban reserve process that really can help you do the kind of planning you say you want to do.
Okay, any more questions for these gentlemen? Okay, thank you very
much. All right,
thank you. All right, I'd like to call Mary Kyle McCurdy, Mary Ann Nash, and Mike Silvaggio up. Mary Kyle, I've got you first.
Good morning, Chair Clem and members of the committee. Mary Kyle McCurdy, Deputy Director of 1000 Friends of Oregon. We're here to oppose both of the bills, and I will briefly address first the urban reserve one. It would allow, as you've heard, soils class 7 and 8 soils to automatically move to the top of the list for urban growth boundaries and urban reserves. But we believe this bill is not needed. There is already the urban reserve process that is designed exactly to meet the need that you've heard about, planning for infrastructure, where it's going to be needed beyond the current urban growth boundary. That's why it was created. It allows, rather than automatically taking into certain lands into an urban reserve, it allows a city to go through a methodical community conversation about which lands around an urban growth boundary are appropriate to include in an urban reserve, farmlands too, as well as rural residential areas. And then once land, like the class 7 and 8 soils, if that's what the city decides, are inside an urban reserve, that's the first choice that the city can go to for their UGB expansion. This rulemaking is an unnecessary cost to have DLCD do this. The city has the time to start the urban reserve process now. Turning to the other bill, 2894, parts of the bill, we also oppose that parts of the bill are unnecessary and parts are poor policy. The Dash 1 amendments provide that when evaluating which lands to bring inside an urban growth boundary, a city shall take into account certain characteristics that could impede the buildable capacity of those lands, including topography, cost of infrastructure provision, and the degree to which an area is already developed. However, that is already the law. Goal 14 requires that cities take into account the following when determining where to expand an urban growth boundary: the efficient accommodation of identified land needs, the orderly and economic provision of public facilities and services, social and economic consequences, and compatibility of urban uses with farm and forest uses. These are already required in Goal 14. And about a year ago, LCDC adopted streamlined Goal 14 rules that apply to any urban growth boundary expansion, including Ben's next one, whenever that is. That allows a city to exclude certain lands from even being considered for UGB expansion if they are impracticable to provide necessary public facilities or services, or if they're subject to certain development hazards. It also allows cities to discount the development capacity based on pre-existing development and parcelization. Again, those parts of the bill are not needed. I will turn to the part of the bill that allows, that would direct LCDC to adopt rules recognizing private contracts of covenants and conditions that restrict homeowner development or development on residential land. These are private contracts between a homeowner and a homeowner association. That when in this instance they are entered into outside of urban growth boundaries, if that land is brought into an urban growth boundary, this bill proposes that they would that those contracts would be honored, private contracts limiting the development capacity of those lands. That is not going to address any housing need, affordable or otherwise, in Bend if those contracts are honored when they come in. I also want to note that LCDC considered this issue at length when it did its streamlined urban growth boundary rules and rejected the idea that cities and counties should have to recognize private contracts. We heard a lot of testimony during that process from cities that say there are private contracts out there between homeowners and homeowners associations that in some cases are 50, 75 years old. Sometimes they're 5 years old. They range over a variety of subjects. They don't all address the development capacity. Some address whether you can water your lawn or what color you can paint your house. For a city to know which ones are still being enforced by a private homeowners association and whether or not they impact the development of the capacity of land is really cumbersome for cities. And moreover, these are private contracts that run contrary to Goal 10, our housing requirements that cities provide, and potentially the federal fair housing laws to wall off certain parts of a community from what has been a collective community decision about the types of housing that should be provided in a city. Today, cities can and do take into account the development and redevelopment capacity of existing lands without looking at private contracts. Every city, when they're looking to see whether a land is likely to be redeveloped, that is increased in density over the 20-year planning period, they take into account the value of the structure on land and the value of the land, whether it's residential, industrial, commercial, to determine whether or not that land is likely to redevelop and densify over the 20-year planning period, and they discount it based on that, on objective criteria, not on private contracts. Thank you.
Marianne, yeah.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, Mary Ann Nash here today on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. We have similar concerns, but I'll focus more on the agricultural side of it. For House Bill 2893, we're concerned that it's too broad of a brush and it's a statewide approach. While I am sympathetic and agree with the concerns expressed by the city that those areas are not valuable agricultural land because they are too parcelized, that condition doesn't exist everywhere that there are Class 6 through 8 soils, or even Class 7 and 8 soils, as they're some of the most valuable rangeland in the state and other parts of the state, and I'm working on getting a map of those that I think would also benefit the committee. But while we are sympathetic to the concerns, we think this is simply too broad of a brush and too broad of an approach to take, particularly when there are existing avenues through law for them to resolve the concerns. Regarding House Bill 2894, on the agricultural side, while we're certainly again sympathetic to the city's concerns about how to plan for growth, any time that you allow less development within the UGB, you create more pressure outside the UGB for a lot of communities. That's going to mean looking to ag land and causing more rapid development of ag land. That is the balancing act that the legislature has struck in the land use planning system, and we're worried that this would disrupt the balance that the system already has and has already created. And so I guess on that one, just urging caution in the approach and recognizing that any time you're allowing less density within UGBs, that is creating more pressure on the UGB expansion process into agricultural lands and ultimately depleting our agricultural land base. So with that, I will also conclude, and just wanted to apologize. We're both due next door as soon as we get a text, so I may ask permission to jump out if we do get that text while we're here.
Okay, well, maybe we should take questions in case you jump out. Are you also going next door?
If there's time, actually.
Yeah, we're all three.
Okay, well, Mike, why don't you, and then we'll see what we can get in here before you leave.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll be brief. For the record, Michael Silvaggio, I'm here for Central Oregon Land Watch. I'd just like to say that we recognize and very much appreciate the City of Bend's interest in thinking ahead. It's this type of advanced planning that's appreciated and correct in creating a well-balanced approach to planned communities. But we believe at this time this seems to be a premature approach. However, I'll be very, very delicate because we have not reviewed the -1 amendments on the bills. And so I'll be willing to give the city the benefit of the doubt until we have a chance to look those over. But I'll put on the record that, as noted, the city's land needs have recently been established and met with a recent UGB expansion. There's already ways for new agricultural lands to be considered and rezoned. We do share the Farm Bureau's concerns about the broad brush on the soil classifications. In my theme of being brief, I'll just say that Central Oregon Land Watch has not opposed any recent applications for rezoning on the east side of Bend. We appreciate and look forward to continued collaboration with the city, and well, I'm looking forward to seeing what the amendments look like.
Okay, questions for these folks? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Marianne, would it be at all helpful if we put some sideboards on the bills that it only lands within, say, X number of miles of a downtown core area or something like that? Would that be helpful?
Chair Clem, Representative Witt, potentially, and I'm working, and I promised the city I'd work on getting a soil classification map to look at what areas of the state we're actually talking about. My suspicion is that a lot of lands further east are also class 7 through 8, and I'm not familiar enough with the planning systems in those cities to know whether the concern, how far the concern carries. So I told them I'd look at that and try to see if it is something that, you know, could only apply to the city of Bend. My suspicion is it could apply more broadly, and that's the basis for our concern.
Thank you for your work.
Vice Chair McClain.
I guess this is, I don't know who it's for, but anybody who can answer it. What is the process right now as far as urban reserves in other areas of Oregon besides the Tri-County area? Is it completely, you know, just one jurisdiction by one jurisdiction on how they're handling that?
I can answer that.
I see somebody raising their hand. Are you DLCD?
I think we should have you all come up and ask you process questions and let these three go to their next meeting if there's no other question for these three.
Chair Clem, I could answer a part of
that. We need DLCD for other things anyway.
Okay.
So let's anything else
for
these
three?
Well,
I would like her to answer that if it's okay.
Okay, sorry, please,
Chair
Clem, answer.
Well, thank you. One question is that Newburgh, LCDC will tell you who else has urban reserves, but Newburgh has urban reserves, which they have used in exactly this way in order to go to farmland before rural residential areas, because once you're in urban reserve, you can pick amongst those. So.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we have other bills. That's why I'm trying to get us moving, too. Could you, DLCD, please join us on this question? And I think there's probably at least one other process question I've got.
Good morning, Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Rob Halliburton. I'm Community Services Division Manager with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And I'm here to entertain any questions you may have.
I guess my first question was just on how far behind are all these other jurisdictions on urban reserve planning? Because if they say they want to have good long-term planning, but there has to be a process to get that going.
Chair Clem, Representative McLean, to say they're behind isn't exactly accurate. The law is an authority for cities to establish an urban reserve. There's no requirement that any city do so. There's about a half a dozen cities. I wasn't expecting this question, so I was just trying to scribble down out of memory. And there are areas around the state, the whole Bear Creek Valley in Jackson County, Redmond in Central Oregon, Ontario, and Pendleton in Eastern Oregon, and Sandy and Newburgh in the Western Oregon have established urban reserves, outside metro, of course. And I'm probably forgetting some, but that's most of the urban reserves that have been established in the state.
So just to follow up on that question, the infrastructure costs and the years that it takes to build infrastructure, whether it be roads or sewers or anything else, I mean, can be anywhere from 5 to 20 years, depending on what you're trying to build. So how do how do those cities, if they don't have urban reserves, how do they plan ahead and think about those types of infrastructure costs in the current process?
Well, I'm not being a city engineer, I can't really tell you exactly. I would say that they do the best they can. Even in those cities with urban reserves, they don't actually do their public facilities planning outside the urban growth boundary. The detailed public facilities planning really is contained inside urban growth boundaries. So even those cities with urban reserves are making their best guess of what their public facilities needs in those extraterritorial areas may be.
Okay, thank you.
So, Rob, there was a mention about rules that were relatively recently passed that currently already allow discounting of lands that are not likely to develop to urbanizational standards. Can you verify that and explain how that works?
Chair Clem, yes. During the development of the rules that were required by House Bill 2254 from 2013, what we're calling the simplified UGB method, this body gave DLCD an appropriation to do some research, which we used to contract with the planning school at the University of Oregon. Mm-hmm. And they did research on how much redevelopment is actually taking place in areas brought into urban growth boundaries. And from that research, the rule does allow cities to discount the presumed capacity of land to redevelop when it's studying lands to bring into the UGB. Lands an acre or less are presumed that they will not redevelop. Land from 1 to 2 acres is allowed to be discounted 50%, and the research found that those parcels that are over 2 acres would develop at full urban densities once brought into the UGB and provided with services.
So, and some of this I think I have right, but I want to verify it with you, and also I think every person on this committee wasn't on the Land Use Committee when we made 2254, so some of this is just for their benefit, too. 2254 is not the only way urban growth boundaries expand. It's a new method that hasn't been used yet that we're developing that cities can choose to use or not.
that part.
That is correct, yes.
Okay. And so what you're describing is in this new method, if a city uses that method instead of the way they've been expanding urban growth boundaries, they could be discounted in the ways you just described under the rules.
That is also correct.
Okay. If they use the existing urban growth boundary method like Ben just did and not next time using the new one, is there a way to discount in the existing urban growth boundary method?
Yes, we believe there is. It might not be exactly the way that Bend wants to do it, but there are opportunities to do the analysis.
And I'm thinking actually not of Bend. I'm thinking of in East Salem, Jan Ray, that are one-acre lots, and I'm wondering if this, they're not here, I'd ask them, but I'm wondering if the city of Salem ever discounts those, because it's been now since land use planning started 44 years, and they're still one-acre lots, I notice. And people seem to like it that way. I'm not complaining. They're my constituents. I wouldn't want to do that about them. But they don't seem to ever subdivide, I notice, out there.
I don't want to leave the committee with the wrong impression. I'm actually not our UGB specialist. He's at a hearing next door also. and it's my understanding that cities can and have looked at the redevelopment capacity of lands brought into the UGB forever, even before the new rules. But whether the new rules changed those requirements for what we're calling the traditional method, I'm going to backpedal on that. I'm sorry. We may have adopted some rules that changed that even for the traditional method.
And then over on the soil classification type, what is the existing latitude for cities to sort of beyond what's currently in the statute for moving a UGB out and having an easier time if they don't go on to good soils, I assume, like exception lands or non-resource lands? Is it largely indiscriminate past that point? And if you move your boundary out, there is no further prioritization? Because what I'm gathering here is that part of what Ben's trying to do is put things that they think they're likely to go on to into some sort of safe harbor so they don't get sued as easily. Because even if in human terms we can all agree, yeah, that's the worst soil, somebody who doesn't like urban growth boundary expansion generally may sue them anyway over process questions just to drag it out longer. And I feel like they're trying to get a safe path to grow onto less desirable soils. Otherwise, they could just use their own discretion to go on to 6, 7, and 8 as a proposal and not have the legislature intervene in this.
Chair Clem, I won't speculate on Ben's motives, I guess, but there is a priority system in the statute already that requires a city to look at the highest priority lands first, and all farmland is outside that top priority. The rural residential areas, non-resource lands designated by the county, and urban reserve areas are that top priority, and a city's only allowed to look at the exclusive farm use lands if there's insufficient land in the top priority area to accommodate their need. And so in Ben's case, they may have exception areas on the west side where they don't want to grow. I'm not exactly sure what the circumstances are, but those priorities are set in statute right now. And so there would be an opportunity for a successful appeal if a city moved on to exclusive farm use lands before they exhausted the higher priority lands.
And I could see a little bit of a conundrum if you've got rural subdivisions that you're worried will never develop, and you go there because you have to under what you just described, because they're probably zoned rural residential. So you go there, and then they never really develop. Then you just took in a bunch of lands into the UGB that aren't really developable. Meanwhile, you have these rocky areas that no one's really farming that you'd rather have gone on to, but currently you need to go to rural residential exception and non-resource first.
Chair Clem, you'll see in our written testimony that we believe there is already a process in place for the county to designate non-resource lands, mm-hmm. where it would look more nuanced look at whether the land is in fact valuable for farm use. Mm-hmm. It's not just a soils-based analysis, and it would be based on public involvement at the local level, mm-hmm. and other considerations besides just the soils. Mm-hmm. And if the county were to go through that exercise and designate non-resource lands with this more detailed analysis, then it would raise those lands to the highest priority. In my conversations with the city, they've have told me that they've talked to the county, and the county is not on their work program to do that work. So it's a timing
This is in your written testimony on OLIS. Is that what you meant?
Correct.
Okay. I haven't seen that. Thanks so much for providing some. Okay. I think everyone's probably getting close to sick of land use for the day, but just in case, any questions?
Not me.
Not you? Yeah.
I just said...
Vice Chair McLean.
I'm always excited to see people trying to problem solve real problems in real places, and so I think that's important, and I think the city of Bend, you know, feels that there is a real problem. I do feel like if we'd go back and read the process for the express, you know, rules that you've been making and really look at what is there, that it's important for us not to be redundant nor to bring less clarity, because we've taken some statutes and we've not really brought any clarity or any specific change to it that isn't already on the books. And so to me, that's where we're at, is we all need to go back and read that regular process. And also, if you have a choice between a regular process and a new express process, you can use either. And so why would we put a third process? So I think it's important for us to all go back and kind of look this over. So thank you for all your information today.
Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay, thank you. I'm going to close the public hearings on House bills. Oh, I'm so sorry. Cindy, I almost missed you because you weren't on both, and I was looking at the wrong sheet. Very sorry about that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Cindy Robert for Metro today. This is an interesting situation for us because actually House Bill 2893 does not apply to us. It says cities outside of Metro. But what it allows cities to do is something that we already do, and that's the discounting of the supply of buildable land. We already do that. And we actually believe that state law, and I think you, Mr. Chair, alluded to this, allows us to do that and allows the rest of the state to do that. That's our belief. But the problem is, by saying that other cities in the state can do it in this bill, it makes it sound like we can't, and we do this. So our concern seems somewhat conceptual, and it seems like, well, you could put that in the bill, but the relating to clause precludes us from being included. So we're in a little bit of a conundrum. If you decide to move the bill forward, we would appreciate it if there was some kind of legislative intent made very clear that this is not to preclude Metro from doing what we already do. Again, we do believe that Metro and the other cities in the state can already do this under law. So, thank you. And I won't take any questions because I don't know anything about this subject.
Okay. I love honesty.
All right. Then let's close the public.
Read her speech.
That's the best testimony yet.
I love that.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2893 and 2894 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3232 and ask Representative Escobar to tell us about this bill.
Oh, 3232.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, on three. Yeah, it's how exciting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sal Escobar, Representative of District 6, Medford. House Bill 3232 is a way for us as a state to not have species introduced within the state without the permission of the Game Commission itself. Now, the reason I say that is because I'm going to go back a little bit, and we're going to talk a little bit about wolves, and I have nothing against a wolf. I think they have their place. But OR7 went down to Susanville, California, came back up by between Medford and Klamath Falls, and then all of a sudden there was three different adults with OR7, and I asked our game commission, where did the three come from? Well, they didn't know. So I don't know how they got there. They don't know how they got there, but I would suspicion that maybe someone put them there, because three of them just didn't walk down and decide to call on OR7, Southern Oregon. So this would prevent, basically, we're looking at introduction of species within the state of Oregon that maybe we don't want to have within our state, and it gives us the last day. Since it's our state, I think we need to have the last say on it. So that's basically what it's about. And it doesn't prohibit anyone from, I believe now it's against the law that if you take from a pond of A to pond B and introduce a fish I think that is against the law right now. So wouldn't have any effect on the current laws we certainly have today. But I think it's time that we controlled our destiny within our own state. Any questions?
I did. That one of my questions was, what's already illegal? But we can maybe get to that as we go here, too. Representative Barreto?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding is they're now introducing grizzly bears up into the Cascades in Washington, or they plan on doing that. So does this, would this stop the federal government from bringing grizzly bears and planting them into Killala County?
Chair Clem, Representative Barreto, I would certainly hope that we would at least have some input on that. And this is a real simple bill, actually. It's just that we want to be part of the conversation and we want to have the last say.
Any further questions, Representative? We have three to come and tell us why they're not so excited about it, but maybe we'll get back to you
that's
after
fine.
That. Okay. Okay. I think that's it for now. And then let me call Tom Wolf, Bob Bailey, and Bob Salinger up.
Watch Wolf. He's...
I'm not taking you fishing, sorry.
That's a good thing because I want to catch something, Tom.
Oh. Yes. Yeah, you're reportedly a good fisherman. Somebody just took a shot at that. Can you please correct the record?
Chair Clem, committee members for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, a really good fisherman. I have proof. I have pictures. And I'm here representing Trout Unlimited. You already know the stats that I've quoted in the past on how many members we have. I'm here to oppose 3232. And the main reason is because I'm a fish guy to talk about fish. Under Oregon statute, it says that wildlife means fish, shellfish, amphibians, reptiles, anything. So this bill, and you have a written testimony that I sent electronically, could have a major impact on reintroduction of fish. Something that I've been involved with, and Trout Unlimited has been involved with, is taking native fish and reintroducing them into their areas where they've been extirpated from. For example, we have done a lot of work in the southern Appalachians to reintroduce southern brook trout into their habitat. We have reintroduced Apache trout into their habitat in the Chiricahuas in Arizona. Gila trout in their range in New Mexico, greenback trout in Colorado, and here in Oregon, we've been actively involved in reintroducing bull trout back in, for example, into the Clackamas, where they were extirpated 70 years ago, and now there's a healthy population on the Clackamas. So to me, and it's unclear from the language here, A, whether that would impact the work that we're doing. One of the things I'm going to do when I retire is move to allow us and help the Nez Perce tribe and ODFW reintroduce sockeye into the Wallowa, where they were originally native and were a huge run at one time, and there's efforts to do that. So the language to this is unclear, and the way it's interpreted right now, it could possibly impact that reintroduction of native fish into their extirpated habitat. B, I'm not sure, and you can certainly ask ODFW. I think ODFW already has the authority to do many of the things listed here. And so for that many reasons, because of the language, because of the vagueness and concerns we have about how this will impact Trout Unlimited's mission here in Oregon, we're going to oppose the bill. But we're open to amendments, but currently in the language that it is right now, it's just not acceptable to us. Thank you.
Bob Bailey, I've got next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bob Bailey, Robert Bailey, I'm representing Oregon Shores Conservation Coalition. We, too, have some serious concerns about the bill. I've submitted testimony electronically that's fairly detailed, so I won't go over those. But we're concerned that this really limits the ability of the state of Oregon to play a role in the recovery of a variety of species. Oregon itself may not be critical to the continued existence of the species, but it will help perhaps to ensure the long-term sustainability and resiliency of species throughout all of their ranges. So we're concerned that this is a very narrow basis for determining whether or not to approve a reintroduction of species that were once found in Oregon. We are very sensitive to rulemaking and to solve real problems on the ground. We support that. But we're, again, very concerned that this would set up a real hurdle for the Fish and Wildlife Commission to establish rules even before approving introduction of a species that would prohibit good on-the-ground management as things unfold. So we understand Representative Esquivel's concerns here, but we don't believe that this bill addresses the real need in the real world in which species are continuing to decline, and especially in the face of climate change and changing habitats and ecosystems. Thank you.
And our other Bob.
Good morning, Chair Clem and members of the committee. My name is Bob Salinger. I'm here representing Portland Audubon Society, and we have about 17,000 members in Oregon. We're also here to oppose this bill. We believe this bill would add some very onerous new requirements to species reintroduction into Oregon. And they would add an extra layer of bureaucracy, politicization, confusion, duplication, and expense to that process. We believe that ODFNW already has the authority to work with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, or NIMFS, on these reintroductions. We've been part of many of those, and we've worked closely with all those agencies. I don't think we've ever worked on a species reintroduction where we weren't working hand in hand with ODFNW throughout that process. So we see them as very actively engaged in already having the authority to participate. What concerns us here is this adds some very specific requirements, including rulemaking, notice, a variety of different specific issues that ODFNW would have to research. And we believe that many aspects of this are unclear as well. For example, it requires ODFNW to participate to the maximum extent practicable. What does that mean exactly? Is that the maximum extent allowed? Is that the maximum extent they can afford? Is that the maximum extent they have staffing for? ODFNW is an agency that is definitely cash-strapped, and so do they even have the capacity to do some of the things that are in here? And if they don't, are they failing to meet the obligations? Another example is it requires ODFNW to determine whether the species is essential to the continued existence of the species, whether the reintroduction is essential. If, in fact, they find out that it's not, does that mean they're precluded from allowing it to happen? Or is that just something they have to research and determine? U.S. Fish and Wildlife does that already, so why duplicate that process? And again, it's unclear what they would how they would use that information in terms of making a decision. Many of the species we introduce are not necessarily essential to the continued survival of the species. It may be simply like a fish species that people want access to in certain places. Finally, it requires notice to the legislators in the districts where they will be affected. Obviously, many of the species move around. Is that the area where the species is being reintroduced specifically, or is that the area where a species might go to? Just a quick example. We worked on peregrine falcon introduction, and again, we worked hand-in-hand with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I don't think we ever did anything on that project without working directly with both agencies and seeking their input and approval and having them coordinated as well. I believe that if this had been in place, that process would have taken much, much longer, would have cost much more, would have been much more controversial than it was, and would have delayed the delisting of that species in the state of Oregon. I think we'd still have it listed today if we had to go through the processes described in this bill. Instead, we delisted it over a decade ago. So I think we can get there with the existing mechanisms. I think this just adds more bureaucracy, honestly. So thank you.
Tom, when you do these various introductions,
that you just described in some other states and in Oregon. Do you check in with ODF&W before you just start putting fish in rivers?
Yes, we do. In fact, I didn't get specific. We always work closely with either the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, NOAA, or the state agencies, but none of these are ever done on our own. And actually, for most of them, they're the leads, and they come to us asking for assistance in doing their mission. So I didn't mean to imply in my vague language that it's just us doing that. We always work closely with the state and federal agencies on these, with us being the supporter more often than the lead.
Okay. Representative Barreto.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I appreciate the comments, and one of them, I think, from my perspective is I think you mentioned the cost to the ODF&W, you know, in doing this. And so I'm just wondering, as species are introduced like the wolves, you know, and the economic impact that goes along with them, also the impact to fish and wildlife, to now put biologists on staff just to take care of that species, and you start introducing other species that they can't quite handle economically, and looking at this state and where we're going economically over the next 20 years, I don't know, and ODF&W and their budget, you know. So I kind of like the idea of this bill saying, look, if you want to invest in new species coming in, that there's an economic impact to it, and we should probably look at that before you just say, oh, yeah, let's go ahead and bring them all in. So.
Chair Clem, Representative Barreto, speaking from the fish side, reintroduction of native fish into their original habitat is good economically. We have, within Oregon, recreational fishing brings into our economy approximately $1.4 billion a year, and there is a large culture out there, a large group of people like me that really love to fish for native trout. So when the reintroduction of salmon above the Pelton Rambut Dam, the reintroduction of bull trout, that's going to open up a large group for people to fish and bring their money into the local economy. So at least from a fish point, I can't speak to a wildlife point. That's not my area of expertise. But when we've done these introductions and been involved with these introductions across the nation, it's always eventually brings great economic value for the state.
Okay, follow-up. Oh. Yeah, and that's exactly what I was talking about. I mean, if there's a positive side of it, then great. Let's bring out the positive side. If there's a negative side, then let's look at that too. But overall evaluating for what's best for Oregon.
Okay. Where's our basketball?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. With the introduction of species that have been in the state of Oregon at one time and are no longer, Tom, have you ever not conferred with the Game Commission on those issues and ODF&W? Because they're one and the same almost.
Short answer, no. We've always something we believe strongly, Chair Clem, Representative Esquivel, or as I call you, the guy that doesn't think I'm a good fisherman.
Well, we just see the Safeway sign in the back.
Yeah,
and have a picture.
But I'm still working on how to figure out to crop that out of the picture. So, so anyway, getting back to your question and turning very red in the process, we've always worked closely with ODFW and all the things, and a lot of times they're the lead and they work closely with us. So I guess the short answer is no. We never do go out and do anything without working with the state fish and wildlife agencies, whether it's in Oregon or other states.
Follow up. So, Tom, what we're saying is that this just kind of puts it in writing what we do anyway.
Chair Clem, Representative Esco, and I understand your motives, and I think they're noble motives. I guess what I would like to do is just make it a little bit more clear, I think there's just a certain amount of vagueness, and maybe I'm wrong, and certainly, you know, I've been wrong, just like I've never caught fish at times in my life, but And so, but I guess what I'm asking for, just amendments to make this a little clearer, and so that we can make sure that we're doing within this bill things that aren't already done by ODFW, and maybe and hopefully, and I can see that maybe that it didn't answer your question, but I was hoping it would. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Then Tom, you'd be willing to work with me and make sure we have the proper amendments.
Chair Clem, Representative Escobar, yes, I will.
Okay.
As long as you don't tease me about not catching fish. So.
We're going to find out this summer.
Okay. Any further questions for this group? And does anybody want to have ODF&W come up to ask about current Good. Practice? Okay, thank you, gentlemen. I think we're okay on time. Shannon, can you come up? We're not gonna leave Raquel hanging on the next bill. We'll get there. Somebody withdrew their own bill today, so the one about lowering fees. You two probably had something to do with that. You scared them off about your revenue sources, I'm guessing, but okay. So can you tell us kind of what's the current requirement for people before they introduce a wildlife species into Oregon from your perspective, the agency's perspective?
Sure. Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Shannon Hearn, Deputy Director at Department of Fish and Wildlife. It is illegal for any private citizen into the state that doesn't seek our authority to introduce any species. So there's permits, there's licenses, those kind of things, depending on what species we're talking about and what range. So that covers the private citizen fairly well and very clearly. When we get to our authority and introductions, we do very much partner with the federal agencies, especially if they have oversight through the Endangered Species Act or some other mechanism, funding, another one. And then we do work through our Fish and Wildlife Commission and our Fish and Wildlife Management plans to determine where introductions, reintroductions, and those types of things will occur. Many of them do go through the public process at our commission meetings. Obviously, we didn't prepare testimony or analysis of this, and part of it was because of that wildlife term is so broad. So we're covering all native, non-native, fish, wildlife, everything in the state that might potentially move on its own or that we might attempt to reintroduce. And it was pretty broad. So we wanted to hear a little bit about what the bill was about.
Okay. That's helpful. Representative Escobar.
But everything that we encompass, thank you, Mr. Chair, everything we encompass in the state of Oregon should be broad, because it doesn't matter what the species is wildlife, whether it be a fish, a bird, a game animal, or whatever. Isn't that correct?
Chair Clem, Representative Escobar, that is correct. But in quickly looking at this and getting into the details, if you take Oregon chub, which was the first fish species to nationally come off the endangered species list, what we did was we had to go out and actually find places outside its current range to reestablish it. That's what brought it off the list. Mm. And in doing that, we had to do safe harbors with landowners. We couldn't tell people where that was occurring. And so in that specific case, then you really don't want a very bureaucratic, broad process, because you can't be absolutely transparent. You're coming in and you're basically saying very broadly, we're going to reestablish the species outside its current range. If you look at mountain quail, that's another one. Historically, its range was outside the Cascades on the west side. We're trying to reestablish it in the east. If we have every time to go through the process of saying, we're going to try it again here, we're going to try it again here, and moving those, it gets very expensive, very fast. So what we would do, it would do a broad management plan and basically just indicate counties and places that we'd want it to go. And I'm not sure if we're meeting the intent of what House Bill 3232 does. If you really want to look species by species where we're going, you want a stringent analysis of where it currently is, where it may go, or we may introduce it. That's
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Escobar.
But we didn't take mountain quail and arbitrarily take them to the east to reintroduce them without the consent of the Game Commission, correct?
Chair Clem, Representative Escobar, that is correct.
I don't care what we do in the state of Oregon, but I'm concerned with people from outside the state of Oregon, organizations, U.S. Fish and Wildlife. I'm concerned with what they're doing.
Are we allowed to tell U.S. Fish and Wildlife it's our state? You can't introduce something here if they've got federal legal authority to do so?
Chair Clem, Representative Escobar, to this point, we rely very much on their goodwill and the relationships we have to have conversations with them. But certainly in the cases of grizzly bear and wolves, we did not have the ability to say, no, we really prefer they not be introduced close to our state because we think they're likely to come here. Same with moose that have shown up out of eastern Washington into the state of Oregon. We do confer with them, but we don't have any authority to say no.
And do we even know if in the case of wolves, what was it, Montana? Where did it start? Idaho?
Actually, they started in Wyoming and Yellowstone, where they're reared.
And did that state want it at the time?
Washington and Oregon now.
Did Montana voluntarily agree, or was it a federal decision?
Chair Clem, it's a it's a federal land holding. So the state even tried to oppose Wyoming, I know, did.
See, they came across the Snake River is what they did.
Oh, yeah, little swimmers.
Yeah.
Okay, any further questions? Okay, and then is Danielle Moser here? Okay, somebody left me a note to ask if she's here, but I don't see her. So that's the end of my list on this bill. I will note I find it enjoyable to hear some of our friends from the environmental movement talk about not wanting to go through bureaucratic processes, because typically that'd be more like the Farm Bureau's testimony or some business who's coming up. So we're all in sympathy on that. So with that little admonition, let's close the public hearing on House Bill 3232 and open the public hearing on House Bill 3051 and ask Raquel to come up. Talk to us about expanding the water measurement cost-sharing program to groundwater users.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity today to provide testimony in support of House Bill 3051. You actually already heard this bill back on February 9th. It was the -2 amendments to House Bill 2297. So I will be brief today and see if there's any questions. The department currently has a cost share measurement program, which allows the department to provide up to 75% of funding for installing a measuring device on surface water diversions. The bill currently is written, or the statute currently is written, only applies to surface water diversions. So we can only partner with water right holders in those instances. This bill proposes to allow the department to provide that same cost share funding to groundwater users. Groundwater use data is particularly important when we're doing groundwater basin studies, as well as assisting us in being able to protect existing water users. So again, this bill, just very briefly, just allows us to make this cost share funding available to groundwater users in addition to the surface water users. So with that, I'll take any questions. Thank you.
Okay, any questions? Not that your issues aren't exciting, but I had forgotten entirely that we already heard this topic. I'm so sorry.
Chair Clem, members, that's why I started with that.
Yeah, that's helpful. I mean, it's been at least 4 or 5 weeks. What do you expect? I can't remember all these things. Okay. Then that's 3051. And this was a -2 to something else. And did we start a new bill? I see it's got our committee's name on it, so I must have approved this.
Chair Clem, yes, members of the committee. The bill, the -2 amendments were outside of the relating to clause of House Bill 2297. And we received that letter, I think, about the same day or the day before the hearing. So we went forward with the hearing on that, talked about it. And then at the same time, you were already having a bill drafted.
And then this committee sponsored it, which I had forgotten that as well.
Chair Clem, that's correct.
Okay, great. Thank you. And I don't see anybody else here on this, so let me close the public hearing on House Bill 3232. And then we've got a few work sessions here. I don't know if anybody needs any more time on any of these.
Mr. Chair, did we skip 3040?
That was the fee reduction. Yeah, somebody, yep. The sponsor asked to withdraw it from today's testimony.
Thank you.
I don't know the backstory yet. Okay, so how about we start, because I know Representative McCune is excited, with HCR 14.
Thank you.
Shuffle down and try the bottom.
You're looking to me for a motion?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Chair Clem, I move HCR 14 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Springer moves HCR 14 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Can we just briefly be reminded what this is about?
Yeah, this was a resolution honoring a really wonderful gentleman from the Coos County area who's helped, I think it was more than 100,000 school kids around Oregon learn about the life cycle of salmon.
And was it, may I,
yeah,
Chair
please.
Clem? He was also just a major player for his entire career in supporting the SIP program and fisheries in general. He's a fish biologist and has been honored by ODF&W, and we think it's very appropriate now as a state to honor the work that he has done over the course of a very, very stellar career.
And he's retiring, and he's having a party sometime soon, and we'd
hoping
like
to
have this thing
done before the retirement actually occurs, and we can honor him as a surprise. So please keep this to yourself.
Oh, I was going to say he seems a little shy. He's not at any of these things. Now I know why. Yeah. Okay, we just won't tell anybody about that. So we won't have him on the floor either because we're going to do it.
We may have him on the floor, okay. Chair Clem, if we can work that out. We're trying to figure out if the secret gets out.
So. Okay.
Thank you.
So that's this one. Okay. Any further discussion?
Trying to pass the resolution.
Any objection to this resolution? Okay, seeing none, so adopted. Okay, let's go back to our little order. This is, can you remind us? I even forgot what the, well, let me open a, did I even open a work session?
Oh, you did on HCR 14.
Did I?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Let's open a work session on House Bill 2533. And remind us, and we have some dash ones, remind us what this is.
Okay, Chair Clem, members of the committee. House Bill 2533 differentiates between pollinator colonies, which are production colonies, and nucleus colonies of bees for the purposes of requiring registration and charging registration fees. And the dash one amendments further clarify that only pollinator colonies or production colonies are subject to application and registration fees.
So this is named bee registration fee. It's really a fee reduction, not a fee increase, or a fee exemption, I guess would be the right term for those of you who are nervous about fees. So.
On that note, you want me to make a motion?
Yeah. Fee reduction motion, please.
Chair Clem, I move to adopt the dash one amendments dated 2817.
Vice Chair Springer moves the dash one amendments dated 2817. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wynn.
Mr. Chairman, I think that non-resident bees should have to pay a higher fee.
I don't think they're eligible for interstate commerce constitutional protections. Why not? Conceptual amendment.
Now that you've said that, I'm voting no.
Okay. Any objections to this dash one? Okay. So adopted.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2533 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Springer moves House Bill 2533 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so adopted. And let me.
This bill.
Yes, we should ask Representative Reardon to carry that bill. Thank you. Now let's open a work session on House Bill 2525. This is Representative Bueller's bill about game meat. We've got these dash one amendments, and I don't really recall what they do exactly. Can you tell us?
Absolutely. Chair Clem, members of the committee, so just to remind you, House Bill 2525 would expand the authorization for inspection of game meat to include animal processing establishments approved and trained by the ODA, and expand the current definition of game meat to include all game animals and fish that have a hunting season determined by ODF&W. The dash one amendments get rid of this idea that animal processing establishments, this kind of a funny wording evidently, is not the right wording. So instead, the dash one amendments clarify that game meat can be inspected to be determined fit for human consumption by an employee of ODFNW, employee of the state police, any person licensed to process meat by Department of Agriculture under the meat processing statute.
Okay, so that's the dash ones. Take a motion.
Chair Clem, I move to adopt the dash one amendments dated 3/3/17.
Vice Chair Springer moves to adopt the dash one amendments dated 3/3/17. Is there any discussion? I think they improved the bill. We had a little bit of testimony about that when Representative Bueller was here. Any objection to these dash ones? Okay, so adopted.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2525 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Springer moves House Bill 2525 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection to this one? Okay, seeing none, so adopted. We'll let Representative Bueller carry his bill, unless one of you want to try and wrestle it away from him. No? Seeing nobody? And this other one about noxious weeds and pollinators, do we not have paperwork?
We do have paperwork, but it has a fiscal on it.
And we're waiting.
So it's going to need to go to Joint Ways and Means. And members of the committee, take a look in your email box. I sent out a list of a few are in that same boat that Chair Clem has asked for you to prioritize, and then for me to kind of see how everybody has voted in, and then you can let the Ways and Means Committee know which are your priorities.
Yeah, I forgot to touch on this again. This is the what I like to call the farm to school problem, where the speaker is not quite ready to have any bills go to Ways and Means and wants us to sort of aggregate them up and talk amongst ourselves before we just carte blanche start sending things down there to our three members over here who probably would like some selectivity rather than their bad guys and gals for everything. And so that's what we've been instructed to do. So this one is sitting in the pile of other things that cost money while we wait. With that, anything else for good of the order? Adjourn the committee a little early.
All right.
Did you check?
They seem to have.
That's cool. Pardon me?
Yeah.
It appears they're not letting me use any of it. That's okay.
Happy to carry the rum bike.
Okay, thank you very much.
I'm making an assumption.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Hi there.
I always try to order yours.
I'm so glad to have you here on land use because I so know.
I'm so glad to have you here on land use because I.